Part of his face is covered by the white gauze mask. Regulation. Two brown eyes, a nose, a head with brown hair on it. His hand is between my legs. Most of those old guys can't make it anymore, he says. Or they're sterile. I almost gasp. He said a forbidden word. Sterile. There is no such thing as a sterile man anymore, not officially. There are only women who are fruitful and women who are barren. That's the law. Lots of women do it, he goes on. You want a baby, don't you? Yes, I say. It's true, and I don't ask why because I know. Give me children or else I die. There's more than one meaning to it. You're soft, he says. It's time. Today or tomorrow would do it. Why waste it? It'd only take a minute, honey. What he called his wife once, maybe still does, but really it's a generic term. We are all honey. I hesitate. He's offering himself to me, his services, at some risk to himself. I hate to see what they put you through, he murmurs. It's genuine. Genuine sympathy, and yet he's enjoying this. Sympathy and all. His eyes are moist with compassion. His hand is moving on me, nervously and with impatience. It's too dangerous, I say. No, I can't. The penalty is death. But they have to catch you in the act, with two witnesses. What are the odds? Is the room bugged? Who's waiting just outside the door? His hand stops. Think about it, he says. I've seen your chart. You don't have a lot of time left, but it's your life. Thank you, I say. I must leave the impression that I'm not offended, that I'm open to suggestion. He takes his hand away, lazily, almost, lingeringly. This is not the last word as far as he's concerned. He could fake the tests, report me for cancer, for infertility, have me shipped off to the colonies with the unwomen. None of this has been said, but the knowledge of his power hangs nevertheless in the air as he pats my thigh, withdraws himself behind the hanging sheet. Next month, he says. I put on my clothes again, behind the screen. My hands are shaking. Why am I frightened? I've crossed no boundaries. I've given no trust, taken no risk. All is safe. It's the choice that terrifies me. A way out. A salvation. Chapter 12. The bathroom is beside the bedroom. It's papered in small blue flowers, forget-me-nots, with curtains to match. There's a blue bath mat, a blue fake fur cover on the toilet seat. All this bathroom lacks from the time before is a doll whose skirt conceals the extra roll of toilet paper. Except that the mirror over the sink has been taken out and replaced by an oblong of tin, and the door has no lock, and there are no razors, of course. There were incidents in bathrooms at first. There were cuttings, drownings, before they got all the bugs ironed out. Cora sits on a chair outside in the hall to see that no one else goes in. In a bathroom and a bathtub, you are vulnerable, said Aunt Lydia. She didn't say to what. The bath is a requirement, but it's also a luxury. Merely to lift off the heavy white wings in the veil, merely to feel my own hair again with my hands is a luxury. My hair is long now, untrimmed. Hair must be long but covered. Aunt Lydia said, St. Paul said it's either that or a close shave. She laughed, that held back neighing of hers, as if she'd told a joke. Cora has run the bath. It steams like a bowl of soup. I take off the rest of the clothes, the overdress, the white shift and petticoat, the red stockings, the loose cotton pantaloons. Pantyhose gives you crotch rot, Moira used to say. Aunt Lydia would never have used an expression like crotch rot. Unhygienic was hers. She wanted everything to be very hygienic. My nakedness is strange to me already. My body seems outdated. Did I really wear bathing suits at the beach? I did, without thought, among men, without caring that my legs, my arms, my thighs, and back were on display, could be seen. shameful, immodest. I avoid looking down at my body, not so much because it's shameful or immodest, but because I don't want to see it. I don't want to look at something that determines me so completely. I step into the water, lie down, let it hold me. The water is soft as hands. I close my eyes, and she's there with me suddenly, without warning. It must be the smell of the soap. I put my face against the soft hair at the back of her neck and breathe her in. Baby powder and child's washed flesh and shampoo, with an undertone, the faint scent of urine. This is the age she is when I'm in the bath. She comes back to me at different ages. This is how I know she's not really a ghost. If she were a ghost, she would be the same age always. One day, when she was 11 months old, just before she began to walk, a woman stole her out of a supermarket cart. It was a Saturday, which is when Luke and I did the week's shopping because both of us had jobs. She was sitting in the little baby seats they had then, in supermarket carts, with holes for the legs. She was happy enough, and I turned my back, the cat food section, I think it was. Luke was over at the side of the store, out of sight, at the meat counter. He liked to choose what kind of meat we were going to eat during the week. He said men needed more meat than women did, and that it wasn't a superstition, and he wasn't being a jerk. Studies had been done. There are some differences, he said. He was fond of saying that, as if I was trying to prove there weren't. But mostly he said it when my mother was there. He liked to tease her. I heard her start to cry. I turned around and she was disappearing down the aisle in the arms of a woman I'd never seen before. I screamed and the woman was stopped. She must have been about 35. She was crying and saying it was her baby. The Lord had given it to her. He'd sent her a sign. I felt sorry for her. The store manager apologized, and they held her until the police came. She's just crazy, Luke said. I thought it was an isolated incident at the time. She fades. I can't keep her here with me. She's gone now. Maybe I do think of her as a ghost. The ghost of a dead girl. A little girl who died when she was 5. I remember the pictures of us I once had. Me holding her. Standard poses, mother and baby, locked in a frame for safety. Behind my closed eyes, I can see myself as I am now, sitting beside an open drawer or a trunk in the cellar where the baby clothes are folded away, a lock of hair, cut when she was 2, in an envelope, white blonde. It got darker later. I don't have those things anymore, the clothes and hair. I wonder what happened to all our things. Looted, dumped out, carried away. Confiscated. I've learned to do without a lot of things. If you have a lot of things, said Aunt Lydia, you get too attached to this material world and you forget about spiritual values. You must cultivate poverty of spirit. Blessed are the meek. She didn't go on to say anything about inheriting the earth. I lie, lapped by the water, beside an open drawer that does not exist, and think about a girl who did not die when she was 5, who still does exist, I hope, though not for me. Do I exist for her? Am I a picture somewhere, in the dark at the back of her mind? They must have told her I was dead. That's what they would think of doing. They would say it would be easier for her to adjust. 8, she must be now. I filled in the time I lost. I know how much there's been. They were right. It's easier to think of her as dead. I don't have to have hope then or make a wasted effort. Why bash your head, said Aunt Lydia, against a wall. Sometimes she had a graphic way of putting things. I ain't got all day, says Cora's voice outside the door. It's true, she hasn't. She hasn't got all of anything. I must not deprive her of her time. I soap myself, use the scrub brush and the piece of pumice for sanding off dead skin. Such Puritan aids are supplied. I wish to be totally clean, germless, without bacteria, like the surface of the moon. I will not be able to wash myself this evening, not afterwards, not for a day. It interferes, they say, and why take chances? I cannot avoid seeing, now, the small tattoo on my ankle. Four digits in an eye, a passport in reverse. It's supposed to guarantee that I will never be able to fade finally into another landscape. I am too important, too scarce for that. I am a national resource. I pull the plug, dry myself, put on my red terry cloth robe. I leave today's dress here, where Cora will pick it up to be washed. Back in the room, I dress again. The white headdress isn't necessary for the evening because I won't be going out. Everyone in this house knows what my face looks like. The red veil goes on, though, covering my damp hair, my head, which has not been shaved. Where did I see that film about the women kneeling in the town square, hands holding them, their hair falling in clumps? What have they done? It must have been a long time ago because I can't remember. Cora brings my supper, covered, on a tray. She knocks at the door before entering. I like her for that. It means she thinks I have some of what we used to call privacy left. "Thank you," I say, taking the tray from her, and she actually smiles at me, but she turns away without answering. When we're alone together, she's shy of me. I put the tray on the small white-painted table and draw the chair up to it. I take the cover off the tray. The thigh of a chicken, overcooked. It's better than bloody, which is the other way she does it. Rita has ways of making her resentments felt. A baked potato, green beans, salad, canned pears for dessert. It's good enough food, though bland. Healthy food. "You have to get your vitamins and minerals," said Aunt Lydia coyly. "You must be a worthy vessel." No coffee or tea, though. No alcohol. Studies have been done. There's a paper napkin, as in cafeterias. I think of the others, those without. This is the heartland here. I'm leading a pampered life. May the Lord make us truly grateful, said Aunt Lydia. Or was it thankful? And I start to eat the food. I'm not hungry tonight. I feel sick to my stomach. But there's no place to put the food, no potted plants, and I won't chance the toilet. I'm too nervous, that's what it is. Could I leave it on the plate? Ask Cora not to report me? I chew and swallow, feeling the sweat come out. In my stomach, the food balls itself together, a handful of damp cardboard squeezed. Downstairs in the dining room, there will be candles on the large mahogany table. A white cloth, silver, flowers, wine glasses with wine in them. There will be the click of knives against china, a clink as she sets down her fork, with a barely audible sigh, leaving half the contents of her plate untouched. Possibly, she will say, she has no appetite. Possibly she won't say anything. If she says something, does he comment? If she doesn't say anything, does he notice? I wonder how she manages to get herself noticed. I think it must be hard. There's a pat of butter on the side of the plate. I tear off a corner of the paper napkin, wrap the butter in it, take it to the cupboard and slip it into the toe of my right shoe from the extra pair as I have done before. I crumple up the rest of the napkin. No one surely will bother to smooth it out to check if any is missing. I will use the butter later tonight. It would not do this evening to smell of butter. I wait. I compose myself. Myself is a thing I must now compose, as one composes a speech. What I must present is a made thing, not something born. 5. Nap. Chapter 13. There's time to spare. This is one of the things I wasn't prepared for. The amount of unfilled time, the long parentheses of nothing. Time as white sound. If only I could embroider, weave, knit, something to do with my hands. I want a cigarette. I remember walking in art galleries through the 19th century, the obsession they had then with harems. Dozens of paintings of harems. Fat women lolling on divans, turbans on their heads or velvet caps, being fanned with peacock tails, a eunuch in the background standing guard. Studies of sedentary flesh, painted by men who'd never been there. These pictures were supposed to be erotic, and I thought they were at the time. But I see now what they were really about. They were paintings about suspended animation, about waiting, about objects not in use. They were paintings about boredom. But maybe boredom is erotic when women do it for men. I wait, washed, brushed, fed, like a prize pig. Sometime in the 80s, they invented pig balls for pigs who were being fattened in pens. Pig balls were large colored balls. The pigs rolled them around with their snouts. The pig marketer said this improved their muscle tone. The pigs were curious. They liked to have something to think about. I read about that in Introduction to Psychology. That and the chapter on caged rats who'd give themselves electric shocks for something to do. And the one on the pigeons, trained to peck a button that made a grain of corn appear. Three groups of them. The first got one grain per peck. The second, one grain every other peck. The third was random. When the man in charge cut off the grain, the first group gave up quite soon. The second group a little later. The third group never gave up. They'd peck themselves to death rather than quit. Who knew what worked? I wish I had a pig ball. I lie down on the braided rug. You can always practice, said Aunt Lydia. Several sessions a day fitted into your daily routine. Arms at the sides, knees bent, lift the pelvis, roll the backbone down, tuck, again. Breathe in to the count of five, hold, expel. We'd do that in what used to be the domestic science room, cleared now of sewing machines and washer dryers, in unison, lying on little Japanese mats, a tape playing Les Sylphides. That's what I hear now in my head as I lift, tilt, breathe. Behind my closed eyes, thin white dancers flit gracefully among the trees, their legs fluttering like the wings of held birds. In the afternoons, we lay on our beds for an hour in the gymnasium between 3 and 4. They said it was a period of rest and meditation. I thought then they did it because they wanted some time off themselves from teaching us, and I know the aunts not on duty went off to the teacher's room for a cup of coffee or whatever they called by that name. But now I think that the rest was also practice. They were giving us a chance to get used to blank time. A catnap, Aunt Lydia called it, in her coy way. The strange thing is we needed the rest. Many of us went to sleep. We were tired there a lot of the time. We were on some kind of pill or drug, I think. They put it in the food to keep us calm. But maybe not. Maybe it was the place itself. After the first shock, after you'd come to terms, it was better to be lethargic. You could tell yourself you were saving up your strength. I must have been there 3 weeks when Moira came. She was brought into the gymnasium by two of the aunts in the usual way, while we were having our nap. She still had her clothes on, jeans and a blue sweatshirt. Her hair was short. She defied fashion as usual, so I recognized her at once. She saw me too, but she turned away. She already knew what was safe. There was a bruise on her left cheek, turning purple. The aunts took her to a vacant bed where the red dress was already laid out. She undressed, began to dress again, in silence, the aunt standing at the end of the bed, the rest of us watching from inside our slitted eyes. As she bent over, I could see the knobs on her spine. I couldn't talk to her for several days. We looked only, small glances, like sips. Friendships were suspicious, we knew it. We avoided each other during the mealtime lineups in the cafeteria and in the halls between classes. But on the fourth day, she was beside me during the walk. Two by two around the football field. We weren't given the white wings until we graduated. We had only the veils, so we could talk as long as we did it quietly and didn't turn to look at one another. The aunts walked at the head of the line and at the end, so the only danger was from the others. Some were believers and might report us. This is a loony bin, Moira said. I'm so glad to see you, I said. Where can we talk? Said Moira. Washroom, I said. Watch the clock. End stall, 2:30. That was all we said. It makes me feel safer that Moira is here. We can go to the washroom if we put our hands up, though there's a limit to how many times a day They mark it down on a chart. I watch the clock, electric and round, at the front over the green blackboard. 2:30 comes during testifying. Aunt Helena is here, as well as Aunt Lydia, because testifying is special. Aunt Helena is fat. She once headed a Weight Watchers franchise operation in Iowa. She's good at testifying. It's Janine, telling about how she was gang-raped at 14 and had an abortion. She told the same story last week. She seemed almost proud of it while she was telling. It may not even be true. At testifying, it's safer to make things up than to say you have nothing to reveal. But since it's Janine, it's probably more or less true.
But whose fault was it? Aunt Helena says, holding up one plump finger.
Her fault. Her fault. Her fault, we chant in unison.
Who led them on?
Aunt Helena beams, pleased with us.
She did. She did. She did. Why did God allow such a terrible thing to happen?
Teach her a lesson. Teach her a lesson. Teach her a lesson. Last week, Janine burst into tears. Aunt Helena made her kneel at the front of the classroom, hands behind her back, where we could all see her, her red face and dripping nose, her hair dull blonde, her eyelashes so light they seemed not there, the lost eyelashes of someone who's been in a fire, burned eyes. She looked disgusting, weak, squirmy, blotchy, pink, like a newborn mouse. None of us wanted to look like that ever. For a moment, even though we knew what was being done to her, we despised her. Cry baby. Cry baby. Cry baby. We meant it, which is the bad part. I used to think well of myself. I didn't then. That was last week. This week, Janine doesn't wait for us to jeer at her. It was my fault, she says. It was my own fault. I led them on. I deserved the pain.
Very good, Janine, says Aunt Lydia. You are an example.
I have to wait until this is over before I put up my hand. Sometimes if you ask at the wrong moment, they say no. If you really have to go, that can be crucial. Yesterday, Dolores wet the floor. Two aunts hauled her away, a hand under each armpit. She wasn't there for the afternoon walk, but at night she was back in her usual bed. All night we could hear her moaning, off and on.
What did they do to her?
We whispered from bed to bed. I don't know. Not knowing makes it worse. I raise my hand. Aunt Lydia nods. I stand up and walk out into the hall as inconspicuously as possible. Outside the washroom, Aunt Elizabeth is standing guard. She nods, signaling that I can go in. This washroom used to be for boys. The mirrors have been replaced here, too, by oblongs of dull gray metal, but the urinals are still there. On one wall, white enamel with yellow stains. They look oddly like babies' coffins. I marvel again at the nakedness of men's lives. The showers right out in the open, the body exposed for inspection and comparison, the public display of privates. What is it for? What purposes of reassurance does it serve? The flashing of a badge. Look, everyone, all is in order. I belong here. Why don't women have to prove to one another that they are women? Some form of unbuttoning, some split crotch routine, just as casual. A dog-like sniffing. The high school is old. The stalls are wooden, some kind of chipboard. I go into the second one from the end, swing the door to. Of course, there are no longer any locks. In the wood, there's a small hole at the back next to the wall, about waist height. Souvenir of some previous vandalism or legacy of an ancient voyeur. Everyone in the center knows about this hole in the woodwork. Everyone except the aunts. I'm afraid I'm too late, held up by Janine's testifying. Maybe Moira has been here already. Maybe she's had to go back. They don't give you much time. I look carefully down, aslant, under the stall wall, and there are two red shoes. But how can I tell who it is? I put my mouth to the wooden hole. Moira? I whisper.
Is that you? She says. Yes, I say. Relief goes through me.
God, do I need a cigarette, says Moira.
Me too, I say. I feel ridiculously happy. I sink down into my body as into a swamp. Fenland, where only I know the footing. Treacherous ground, my own territory. I become the earth I set my ear against for rumors of the future. Each twinge, each murmur of slight pain, ripples of sloughed-off matter, swellings and diminishings of tissue, the droolings of the flesh, these are signs, these are the things I need to know about. Each month I watch for blood, fearfully, for when it comes, it means failure. I have failed, once again, to fulfill the expectations of others, which have become my own. I used to think of my body as an instrument, of pleasure, or a means of transportation, or an implement for the accomplishment of my will. I could use it to run, push buttons of one sort or another, make things happen. There were limits, but my body was nevertheless lithe, single, solid, one with me. Now the flesh arranges itself differently. I'm a cloud, congealed around a central object, the shape of a pear, which is hard and more real than I am and glows red within its translucent wrapping. Inside it is a space, huge as the sky at night and dark and curved like that, though black-red rather than black. Pinpoints of light swell, sparkle, burst and shrivel within it, countless as stars. Every month there is a moon, gigantic, round, heavy, an omen. It transits, pauses, continues on, and passes out of sight. And I see despair coming towards me like famine. To feel that empty again, again. I listen to my heart, wave upon wave, salty and red, continuing on and on, marking time. I'm in our first apartment, in the bedroom. I'm standing in front of the cupboard, which has folding doors made of wood. Around me, I know it's empty. All the furniture is gone, the floors are bare, no carpets even. But despite this, the cupboard is full of clothes. I think they're my clothes, but they don't look like mine. I've never seen them before. Maybe they're clothes belonging to Luke's wife, whom I've also never seen, only pictures and a voice on the phone, late at night, when she was calling us, before the divorce. But no, they're my clothes, all right. I need a dress. I need something to wear. I pull out dresses. Black, blue, purple, jackets, skirts. None of them will do. None of them even fits. They're too big or too small. Luke is there, behind me. I turn to see him. He won't look at me. He looks down at the floor where the cat is rubbing itself against his legs, mewing and mewing plaintively. It wants food, but how can there be any food with the apartment so empty? Luke, I say. He doesn't answer. Maybe he doesn't hear me. It occurs to me that he may not be alive. I'm running with her, holding her hand, pulling, dragging her through the bracken. She's only half awake because of the pill I gave her so she wouldn't cry or say anything that would give us away. She doesn't know where she is. The ground is uneven, rocks, dead branches, the smell of damp earth, old leaves. She can't run fast enough. By myself, I could run faster. I'm a good runner. Now she's crying. She's frightened. I want to carry her, but she would be too heavy. I have my hiking boots on, and I think, when we reach the water, I'll have to kick them off. Will it be too cold? Will she be able to swim that far? What about the current? We weren't expecting this. Quiet, I say to her angrily. I think about her drowning, and this thought slows me. Then the shots come behind us, not loud, not like firecrackers, but sharp and crisp, like a dry branch snapping. It sounds wrong. Nothing ever sounds the way you think it will, and I hear the voice. Down! Is it a real voice, or a voice inside my head, or my own voice out loud? I pull her to the ground and roll on top of her to cover her, shield her. Quiet, I say again. My face is wet, sweat or tears. I feel calm and floating as if I'm no longer in my body. Close to my eyes, there's a leaf, red, turned early. I can see every bright vein. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I ease off. I don't want to smother her. Instead, I curl myself around her, keeping my hand over her mouth. There's breath and the knocking of my heart, like pounding at the door of a house at night where you thought you would be safe. "It's all right, I'm here," I say, whisper. "Please be quiet." But how can she? She's too young. It's too late. We come apart. My arms are held, and the edges go dark, and nothing is left but a little window, a very little window, like the wrong end of a telescope, like the window on a Christmas card, an old one. Night and ice outside, and within a candle, a shining tree, a family. I can hear the bells even, sleigh bells from the radio, old music. But through this window I can see, small, but very clear, I can see her going away from me through the trees which are already turning red and yellow, holding out her arms to me, being carried away. The bell awakens me, and then Cora, knocking at my door. I sit up on the rug, wipe my wet face with my sleeve. Of all the dreams, this is the worst. 6. Household. Chapter 14. When the bell is finished, I descend the stairs, a brief waif in the eye of glass that hangs on the downstairs wall. The clock ticks with its pendulum, keeping time. My feet, in their neat red shoes, count the way down. The sitting room door is wide open. I go in. So far, no one else is here. I don't sit, but take my place, kneeling near the chair with the footstool where Serena Joy will shortly enthrone herself, leaning on her cane while she lowers herself down. Possibly she'll put a hand on my shoulder to steady herself, as if I'm a piece of furniture. She's done it before. The sitting room would once have been called a drawing room, perhaps, then a living room. Or maybe it's a parlor, the kind with a spider and flies. But now it's officially a sitting room, because that's what is done in it, by some. For others, there's standing room only. The posture of the body is important. Here and now. Minor discomforts are instructive. The sitting room is subdued, symmetrical. It's one of the shapes money takes when it freezes. Money has trickled through this room for years and years, as if through an underground cavern, crusting and hardening like stalactites into these forms. Mutely, the varied surfaces present themselves. The dusk rose velvet of the drawn drapes, the gloss of the matching chairs, 18th century, the cow's tongue hush of the tufted Chinese rug on the floor, with its peach pink peonies, the suave leather of the commander's chair, the glint of brass on the box beside it. The rug is authentic. Some things in this room are authentic, some are not. For instance, two paintings, both of women, one on either side of the fireplace. Both wear dark dresses, like the ones in the old church, though of a later date. The paintings are possibly authentic. I suspect that when Serena Joy acquired them, after it became obvious to her that she'd have to redirect her energies into something convincingly domestic, she had the intention of passing them off as ancestors. Or maybe they were in the house when the commander bought it. There's no way of knowing such things. In any case, there they hang, their backs and mouths stiff, their breasts constricted, their faces pinched, their caps starched, their skin grayish-white, guarding the room with their narrowed eyes. Between them, over the mantel, there's an oval mirror, flanked by two pairs of silver candlesticks, with a white china Cupid centered between them, its arm around the neck of a lamb. The tastes of Serena Joy are a strange blend. hard lust for quality, soft sentimental cravings. There's a dried flower arrangement on either end of the mantelpiece, and a vase of real daffodils on the polished marquetry end table beside the sofa. The room smells of lemon oil, heavy cloth, fading daffodils, the leftover smells of cooking that have made their way from the kitchen or the dining room, and of Serena Joy's perfume, Lily of the Valley. Perfume is a luxury. She must have some private source. I breathe it in, thinking I should appreciate it. It's the scent of prepubescent girls, of the gifts young children used to give their mothers for Mother's Day, the smell of white cotton socks and white cotton petticoats, of dusting powder, of the innocence of female flesh not yet given over to hairiness and blood. It makes me feel slightly ill, as if I'm in a closed car on a hot, muggy day with an older woman wearing too much face powder. This is what the sitting room is like, despite its elegance. I would like to steal something from this room. I would like to take some small thing, the scrolled ashtray, the little silver pillbox from the mantel, perhaps, or a dried flower, hide it in the folds of my dress or in my zippered sleeve, keep it there until this evening is over, secret it in my room, under the bed, or in a shoe, or in a slit in the hard, petty-point faith cushion. Every once in a while I would take it out and look at it. It would make me feel that I have power. But such a feeling would be an illusion and too risky. My hands stay where they are, folded in my lap. Thighs together, heels tucked underneath me, pressing up against my body, head lowered. In my mouth there's a taste of toothpaste, fake mint and plaster. I wait for the household to assemble. Household. That is what we are. The commander is the head of the household. The house is what he holds. To have and to hold, till death do us part. The hold of the ship. Hollow. Cora comes in first, then Rita, wiping her hands on her apron. They too have been summoned by the bell. They resent it. They have other things to do, the dishes, for instance. But they need to be here. They all need to be here. The ceremony demands it. We are all obliged to sit through this one way or another. Rita scowls at me before slipping in to stand behind me. It's my fault, this waste of her time. Not mine, but my body's, if there is a difference. Even the commander is subject to its whims. Nick walks in, nods to all three of us, looks around the room. He too takes his place behind me, standing. He's so close that the tip of his boot is touching my foot. Is this on purpose? Whether it is or not, we are touching. Two shapes of leather. I feel my shoe soften. Blood flows into it. It grows warm. It becomes a skin. I move my foot slightly away. Wish he'd hurry up, says Cora. Hurry up and wait, says Nick. He laughs, moves his foot so it's touching mine again. No one can see beneath the folds of my outspread skirt. I shift. It's too warm in here. The smell of stale perfume makes me feel a little sick. I move my foot away. We hear Serena coming down the stairs along the hall, the muffled tap of her cane on the rug, thud of the good foot. She hobbles through the doorway, glances at us, counting but not seeing. She nods at Nick, but says nothing. She's in one of her best dresses, sky blue with embroidery in white along the edges of the veil, flowers and fretwork. Even at her age, she still feels the urge to wreathe herself in flowers. No use for you, I think at her, my face unmoving. You can't use them anymore. You're withered. They're the genital organs of plants. I read that somewhere once. She makes her way to her chair and footstool, turns, lowers herself, lands ungracefully. She hoists her left foot onto the stool, fumbles in her sleeve pocket. I can hear the rustling, the click of her lighter.
I smell the hot singe of the smoke. Breathe it in.
Late as usual, she says.
We don't answer.
There's a clatter as she gropes on the lamp table, then a click, and the television set runs through its warm-up. A male choir with greenish-yellow skin. The color needs adjusting. They're singing, "Come to the church in the wildwood."
Come, 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 sing the basses.
Serena clicks the channel changer. Waves, colored zigzags, a garble of sound. It's the Montreal satellite station being blocked. Then there's a preacher, earnest, with shining dark eyes leaning towards us across a desk. These days they look a lot like businessmen. Serena gives him a few seconds, then clicks onward. Several blank channels, then the news. This is what she's been looking for. She leans back, inhales deeply. I, on the contrary, lean forward, a child being allowed up late with the grown-ups. This is the one good thing about these evenings, the evenings of the ceremony. I'm allowed to watch the news. It seems to be an unspoken rule in this household. We always get here on time. He's always late. Serena always lets us watch the news. Such as it is. Who knows if any of it's true? It could be old clips. It could be faked. But I watch it anyway, hoping to be able to read beneath it. Any news now is better than none. First, the front lines. They're not lines, really. The war seems to be going on in many places at once. Wooded hills, seen from above, the trees a sickly yellow. I wish she'd fix the color. The Appalachian Highlands, says the voiceover, where the Angels of the Apocalypse, 4th Division, are smoking out a pocket of Baptist guerrillas with air support from the 21st Battalion of the Angels of Light. We are shown two helicopters, black ones with silver wings painted on the sides. Below them, a clump of trees explodes. Now a close shot of a prisoner, with a stubbled and dirty face, flanked by two angels in their neat black uniforms. The prisoner accepts a cigarette from one of the angels, puts it awkwardly to his lips with his bound hands. He gives a lopsided little grin. The announcer is saying something, but I don't hear it. I look into this man's eyes, trying to decide what he's thinking. He knows the camera is on him. Is the grin a show of defiance? Or is it submission? Is he embarrassed at having been caught? They only show us victories, never defeats. Who wants bad news? Possibly he's an actor. The anchorman comes on now. His manner is kindly, fatherly. He gazes out at us from the screen, looking with his tan and his white hair and candid eyes, wise wrinkles around them, like everybody's ideal grandfather. What he's telling us, his level smile implies, is for our own good. Everything will be all right soon. I promise. There will be peace. You must trust. You must go to sleep, like good children. He tells us what we long to believe. He's very convincing. I struggle against him. He's like an old movie star, I tell myself, with false teeth and a face job. At the same time, I sway towards him like one hypnotized. If only it were true. If only I could believe. Now he's telling us that an underground espionage ring has been cracked by a team of eyes, working with an inside informant. The ring has been smuggling precious national resources over the border into Canada. 5 members of the heretical sect of Quakers have been arrested, he says, smiling blandly. And more arrests are anticipated. 2 of the Quakers appear on screen, a man and a woman. They look terrified, but they're trying to preserve some dignity in front of the camera. The man has a large dark mark on his forehead. The woman's veil has been torn off and her hair falls in strands over her face. Both of them are about 50. Now we can see a city, again from the air. This used to be Detroit. Under the voice of the announcer, there's the thunk of artillery.
From the skyline, columns of smoke ascend.
Resettlement of the children of Ham is continuing on schedule, says the reassuring pink face back on the screen. 3,000 have arrived this week in National Homeland 1, with another 2,000 in transit.
How are they transporting that many people at once? Trains? Buses?
We are not shown any pictures of this. National Homeland 1 is in North Dakota. Lord knows what they're supposed to do once they get there. Farm is the theory. Serena Joy has had enough of the news. Impatiently, she clicks the button for a station change, comes up with an aging bass baritone, his cheeks like emptied udders. Whispering hope is what he's singing. Serena turns him off. We wait. The clock in the hall ticks. Serena lights another cigarette. I get into the car. It's a Saturday morning. It's a September. We still have a car. Other people have had to sell theirs. My name isn't Ufred. I have another name, which nobody uses now because it's forbidden. I tell myself it doesn't matter. Your name is like your telephone number, useful only to others. But what I tell myself is wrong. It does matter. I keep the knowledge of this name like something hidden, some treasure I'll come back to dig up one day. I think of this name as buried. This name has an aura around it, like an amulet, some charm that survived from an unimaginably distant past. I lie in my single bed at night with my eyes closed, and the name floats there behind my eyes, not quite within reach, shining in the dark. It's a Saturday morning in September. I'm wearing my shining name. The little girl who is now dead sits in the back seat with her two best dolls, her stuffed rabbit, mangy with age and love. I know all the details. They are sentimental details, but I can't help that. I can't think about the rabbit too much, though. I can't start to cry. Here, on the Chinese rug, breathing in the smoke that has been inside Serena's body. Not here. Not now. I can do that later. She thought we were going on a picnic. And in fact, there is a picnic basket on the back seat beside her with real food in it. Hard-boiled eggs, thermos and all. We didn't want her to know where we were really going. We didn't want her to tell by mistake, reveal anything if we were stopped. We didn't want to lay upon her the burden of our truth. I wore my hiking boots. She had on her sneakers. The laces of the sneakers had a design of hearts on them, red, purple, pink, and yellow. It was warm for the time of year. The leaves were turning already, some of them. Luke drove. I sat beside him. The sun shone. The sky was blue. The houses as we passed them looked comforting and ordinary. Each house, as it was left behind, vanishing into past time, crumbling in an instant, as if it had never been, because I would never see it again. Or so I thought then. We have almost nothing with us. We don't want to look as if we're going anywhere far or permanent. We have the forged passports, guaranteed worth the price. We couldn't pay in money, of course, or put it on the CompuCount. We used other things. Some jewelry that was my grandmother's, a stamp collection Luke inherited from his uncle. Such things can be exchanged for money in other countries. When we get to the border, we'll pretend we're just going over on a day trip. The fake visas are for a day. Before that, I'll give her a sleeping pill so she'll be asleep when we cross. That way, she won't betray us. You can't expect a child to lie convincingly. And I don't want her to feel frightened, to feel the fear that is now tightening my muscles, tensing my spine, pulling me so taut that I'm certain I would break if touched. Every stoplight is an ordeal. We'll spend the night at a motel, or better, sleeping in the car on a side road so there will be no suspicious questions. We'll cross in the morning, drive over the bridge easily, just like driving to the supermarket. We turn onto the freeway, head north, flowing with not much traffic. Since the war started, gas is expensive and in short supply. Outside the city, we pass the first checkpoint. All they want is a look at the license. Luke does it well.
The license matches the passport. We thought of that. Back on the road, he squeezes my hand, glances over at me. "You're white as a sheet," he says. That is how I feel. White. Flat. Thin. I feel transparent. Surely they will be able to see through me. Worse, how will I be able to hold on to Luke, to her, when I'm so flat, so white? I feel as if there's not much left of me. They will slip through my arms, as if I'm made of smoke, as if I'm a mirage, fading before their eyes. "Don't think that way," Moira would say. "Think that way, and you'll make it happen." "Cheer up," says Luke. He's driving a little too fast now. The adrenaline's gone to his head. Now he's singing. "Oh, what a beautiful morning," he sings. Even his singing worries me. We've been warned not to look too happy. Chapter 15. The commander knocks at the door. The knock is prescribed. The sitting room is supposed to be Serena Joy's territory. He's supposed to ask permission to enter it. She likes to keep him waiting. It's a little thing, but in this household, little things mean a lot. Tonight, however, she doesn't even get that, because before Serena Joy can speak, he steps forward into the room anyway. Maybe he's just forgotten the protocol, but maybe it's deliberate. Who knows what she said to him over the silver-encrusted dinner table, or didn't say. The commander has on his black uniform, in which he looks like a museum guard. A semi-retired man, genial but wary, killing time. But only at first glance. After that, he looks like a Midwestern bank president, with his straight, neatly brushed silver hair, his sober posture, shoulders a little stooped. And after that, there is his mustache, silver also, and after that, his chin, which really you can't miss. When you get down as far as the chin, he looks like a vodka ad in a glossy magazine of times gone by. His manner is mild, his hands large, with thick fingers and acquisitive thumbs. His blue eyes uncommunicative, falsely innocuous. He looks us over as if taking inventory. One kneeling woman in red, one seated woman in blue, two in green, standing, a solitary man, thin-faced, in the background. He manages to appear puzzled, as if he can't quite remember how we all got in here, as if we were something he inherited, like a Victorian pump organ, and he hasn't figured out what to do with us, what we are worth. He nods in the general direction of Serena Joy, who does not make a sound. He crosses to the large leather chair reserved for him, takes the key out of his pocket, fumbles with the ornate, brass-bound, leather-covered box that stands on the table beside the chair. He inserts the key, opens the box, lifts out the Bible, an ordinary copy with a black cover and gold-edged pages. The Bible is kept locked up, the way people once kept tea locked up, so the servants wouldn't steal it. It is an incendiary device. Who knows what we'd make of it, if we ever got our hands on it. We can be read to from it, by him, but we cannot read. Our heads turn towards him. We are expectant. Here comes our bedtime story. The commander sits down and crosses his legs, watched by us. The bookmarks are in place. He opens the book. He clears his throat a little, as if embarrassed. "Could I have a drink of water?" he says to the air. "Please," he adds. Behind me, one of them, Cora or Rita, leaves her space in the tableau and pads off towards the kitchen. The commander sits, looking down. The commander sighs, takes out a pair of reading glasses from his inside jacket pocket, gold rims, slips them on. Now he looks like a shoemaker in an old fairy tale book. Is there no end to his disguises of benevolence? We watch him, every inch, every flicker.
To be a man, watched by women, it must be entirely strange. To have them watching him all the time. To have them wondering, what's he going to do next? To have them flinch when he moves, even if it's a harmless enough move, to reach for an ashtray, perhaps. To have them sizing him up. To have them thinking. He can't do it. He won't do. He'll have to do. This last, as if he were a garment, out of style or shoddy, which must nevertheless be put on because there's nothing else available. To have them putting him on, trying him on, trying him out, while he himself puts them on like a sock over a foot, onto the stub of himself, his extra sensitive thumb, his tentacle, his delicate, stalked slug's eye, which extrudes, expands, winces, and shrivels back into himself when touched wrongly, grows big again, bulging a little at the tip, traveling forward as if along a leaf, into them, avid for vision. To achieve vision in this way, this journey into a darkness that is composed of women, a woman, who can see in darkness while he himself strains blindly forward. She watches him from within. We're all watching him. It's the one thing we can really do, and it's not for nothing. If he were to falter, fail, or die, what would become of us? No wonder he's like a boot, hard on the outside, giving shape to a pulp of tender foot. That's just a wish. I've been watching him for some time, and he's given no evidence of softness. But watch out, Commander, I tell him in my head. I've got my eye on you. One false move, and I'm dead. Still, it must be hell to be a man like that. It must be just fine. It must be hell. It must be very silent. The water appears. The commander drinks it. Thank you, he says. Cora rustles back into place. The commander pauses, looking down, scanning the page. He takes his time, as if unconscious of us. He's like a man toying with a steak behind a restaurant window, pretending not to see the eyes watching him from hungry darkness, not 3 feet from his elbow. We lean towards him a little, iron filings to his magnet. He has something we don't have. He has the word. How we squandered it once. The commander, as if reluctantly, begins to read. He isn't very good at it. Maybe he's merely bored. It's the usual story, the usual stories. God to Adam, God to Noah. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Then comes the moldy old Rachel and Leah stuff we had drummed into us at the center. Give me children, or else I die. Am I in God's stead, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? Behold my maid, Bilhah. She shall bear upon my knees, that I may also have children by her. And so on and so forth. We had it read to us every breakfast, as we sat in the high school cafeteria, eating porridge with cream and brown sugar. You're getting the best, you know, said Aunt Lydia. There's a war on. Things are rationed. You are spoiled girls, she twinkled, as if rebuking a kitten. Naughty puss. For lunch, it was the Beatitudes. Blessed be this, blessed be that. They played it from a tape, so not even an aunt would be guilty of the sin of reading. The voice was a man's. Blessed be the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed be the meek. Blessed are the silent. I knew they made that up. I knew it was wrong, and they left things out, too, but there was no way of checking. Blessed be those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Nobody said when. I checked the clock, during dessert. Canned pears with cinnamon standard for lunch, and look for Moira in her place, 2 tables over.